Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
Well, what's happening with the stock market? Which way is the housing market going? Screaming headlines in the Financial Times today. This is an ongoing story that I think probably the best coverage has been in the Financial Times over the last few weeks. The market, as of this moment right now, the Dow Industrial is down 204 points at 12,657. What does this mean? A large concern that the rating agencies, the agencies that rate credit, principally Moody's and Standard & Poor's, have... they're largely unregulated. They claim First Amendment free speech rights, to quote the Financial Times today, a fascinating article in the Financial Times, and yet they're money-making enterprises who, on some occasions, seem to make more money when they rate things well, and now there's a dose of reality coming into this. I wanted to get the take of an economist who I have tremendous respect for on this issue. Ravi Batra is with us. His website, Ravi, R-A-V-I, Batra, B-A-T-R-A.com. My favorite of all of his books, Greenspan's Fraud. I think it's the essential. You must read this if you want to understand what has happened in the United States in the last 26 years. He's also the author of his newest book, The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. Ravi is also been the author of books about coming disasters. So, Ravi, you are a realist, an optimist, and above all, an economist, a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. Welcome to the program. Ravi?
I'm here.
Hey, there you go. Great to have you with us. A couple of days ago, the Financial Times ran an article in which they talked about how this is an Anglo-American experiment that has never before in the history of modern capitalism been tried, which is allowing banks to, instead of holding mortgages and taking the money from them over the 20 or 30 year life of the mortgage, which in and of itself is pretty much a relatively recent thing, a 20th century phenomena, allowing banks to aggregate these loans, bundle them together, sell them. Now, Fannie Mae in the 30s, Freddie Mac in the 70s came along to reduce the risk to the banks, at the time, government agencies. But now it's become this, anybody can offer a mortgage. Well, not literally, but, pretty much anybody can offer a mortgage. Anybody can bundle it and sell it into the secondary market. And a large chunk of the world's economy has come to be dependent upon these debt instruments. To what extent is this an experiment, and where is it leading? What's going on here?
Well, the real problem is that the economies in the world need so much debt to operate probably, to operate in an efficient way. We should not be needing so much debt so that the economies are good or the economies function smoothly. So that's the real problem. It was not like that 20, 30 years ago, but now, because of the reason, there is a huge wage gap appearing in the world. Wages are not rising as fast as productivity. Productivity is the source of supply. Wages are the source of demand. So if productivity rises much faster than wages, supply will rise much faster than demand, and there will be imbalance in the world economy. So what do they do to fill that imbalance, to correct that imbalance? They create debt, because debt also, creates demand.
But right. In other words, they let people borrow against the value of their home. In fact, this was a point that Walmart made in an article in yesterday's Wall Street Journal, I believe it was, that Walmart is saying that they're expecting their earnings are going to be down because the people who shop at Walmart can't take money out of their homes anymore to buy stuff at Walmart, which is crazy to begin with.
Well, that's the whole point, that the world economies are, the economic policy around the world is so bad, especially in the United States, because the U.S. economic policy controls the economic policy all over the world. The economists don't understand here that we don't have free market capitalism. We have monopoly capitalism, and in that kind of rule, wages don't rise as fast as productivity. In fact, real wages have been coming down in the U.S. while productivity keeps rising. So you have to create more debt, more and more debt, to sustain the rising productivity, and all the increase in profits we see is based on that debt. So now, almost all the debt-creating potential of the system is exhausted. People don't have, they have already had home equity loans. They have already bought cars on zero financing. And so demand is not enough to meet supply. Profits are about to fall, and as a result, the markets are reflecting that. And see, the markets flourish on debt. Now the markets find that debt cannot be created anymore, so they're tanking.
Wow. You know, I this is a revelation to me. I mean, it makes perfect sense that before the Greenspan-Reagan era, by and large, people, you know, you bought a home and the goal was to have equity in your home over time so that your home was paid off by the time you retired, you know, a 30-year mortgage, for example.
When you believe in fundamental values, when you don't believe, that was a good way to do that. That's the economy in the 1950s, 60s, and even in the 1970s were much better than what they have been since the Reagan era, because productivity is rising much faster than wages. So supply is rising much faster than demand. As a result, they keep lowering interest rates and keep creating new and new ways so the public gets lured into more and more debt. A time comes when debt cannot rise anymore. That's when stock markets explode, and that's what's happening right now.
Wow, wow. So
by the way, in my new book, the New Golden Age, that the book is, the title is very optimistic. But unfortunately, there's a subtitle. The subtitle says, "The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos." And I had, the book had come out in February, and I had written that by the middle of the year, we will start the beginning. This is the beginning of the economic chaos. This is the starting point, because the meltdown of the subprime market is just the tip of the vast American mortgage iceberg. It's only, subprime market is only $1 trillion. There are other $4 trillion of fraudulent loans that have been made in the mortgage industry. So this is going to go on and on. And I think the Fed will have to take some strong action, perhaps by the end of this month, that will stabilize the system somewhat. But the fundamental problem is that you need to create more debt to sustain this economy, and debt can't be created anymore, as you can see, and the markets realize that.
Right, right. So how do we Well, two questions come to mind immediately. The first is, if for, you know, 200 years of American history and arguably thousands of years of the history of more or less capitalism, I suppose, growth was based on real wealth, on the actual ownership of assets, including cash, and demand was driven by wages, by
That's
from
right.
the bottom up. I mean,
this is
basically John Maynard Keynes. I mean, this is classic economics, sometimes called demand side economics. And then Reagan came along and said, no, it's supply side. The more stuff there is available, that will grow demand. So what we want to do is we want to increase the supply of things. Demand doesn't matter, which means that you can start cranking down wages and killing off the middle class and move that wealth up into the upper classes, which is exactly what we've seen happen. And economists like yourself and, you know, classic economists were saying this is going to create a disaster. Conservative economists, in quotes, the Chicago School, the Milton Friedman bunch, the Reaganomics guys, the supply side guys, they were all saying, oh, no, this is going to be a wonderful thing. Reagan's got it all figured out. Bush has it all figured out. An $8 trillion debt for the United States doesn't matter. It's only a small percentage of GDP. The chickens are coming home to roost. First of all, how were these changes made? Was it deregulating banks and deregulating the way that loans are made? And if so, by who and when, number one? And number two, what do we do about it? And we have about a minute and a half before we've got to wrap this up, Robbie, or at least take a break.
Well, it's not going to be easy, because this problem, as you say, started from the Reagan's times, and for the past almost 30 years we have been doing this. And so there is a huge debt buildup. The consumers are heavily under debt, and they can't really support the economy anymore. The credit is not available. So one good thing that they are doing is to raise the minimum wage. That will pump money into the pockets of the minimum wage earners, and then they will spend that money without mm-hmm. having to borrow it.
Right.
So that would be helpful to some extent. Whenever minimum wage goes up, the economy actually performs better. I have shown that in Greenspan's fraud and also in this new book, The New Golden Age. It has happened again and again. The rise in the minimum wage actually helps the economy. Take, for instance, 1969. The minimum wage was $8 per hour. Unemployment was 3.5% at that time. That tells you what it does.
Yeah, indeed. We're so talking to Dr.
Help something, but I think on the other side, we have to save money, start saving money, and hope for the best.
Can you stick around for a few minutes, sir?
Sure, I will.
Great. We're talking with Dr. Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University in Texas. Dallas's new book, The New Golden Age. His last book, Greenspan's Fraud. Brilliant books. RaviBatra.com, the website. And the question I want to ask you when we come back from the break, are we looking at another 1929-style crash? And if we are or if we aren't, what should individuals do?
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Well, you can't turn him into a company man. You can't turn him into a whore. And the boys upstairs just don't understand anymore. Well, the top brass don't like him talking so much. There goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play and says what he wants to say. Hey, hey, hey.
Yeah, here he is. 22 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Ravi Batra. RaviBatra.com is website. He's a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, the author of 5 international best-selling books. The latest, The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. Before that, one of my favorite all-time books on economics, Greenspan's Fraud. And Ravi, just let me recapsulize or restate in my own words what I think I understood you to say in our last segment, and then segue from that into this question about, are we seeing 29 recycled? My understanding of what you said is that the engine that drives economic growth is people buying things, otherwise known as demand. People buy things because they make enough money to be able to afford to buy those things, otherwise known as wages. And that demand then causes companies to make things to meet that demand, and the making of those things, one measure of the making of those things, how efficiently and rapidly they're produced, is called productivity. And the goal since prior to Reaganomics, it was, if you want to increase productivity, that is corporate activity, you increase demand. You like Roosevelt did, you put people to work, even if it's the government as the employer of last resort with the WPA or with minimum wages. You say, people are going to earn enough money that they can afford to buy things, which is going to create demand, which is going to stimulate productivity and production. And since Reagan came along, he has said, we don't need no stinking wages. It doesn't matter if people can afford to buy things or not. They will find a way to buy things if the things are offered. And so let's shift everything over to productivity and forget about demand and wipe out the wages of the middle class. And what happened is as the middle class got wiped, and it seemed to work for a while because as the middle class got wiped out, instead of using their wages to buy things, they started using their homes as ATMs. They started buying cars with zero down payment interest loans. They're running up. The average American now has a credit card debt of over $7,000. And so, in other words, all of that demand, again, proving that classic economics works, all of that demand has been driven by credit since Reaganomics. And now the credit train is coming to a screeching halt, which is going to kill off demand, which is going to hurt the companies that are making things to fill that demand, because there won't be the demand anymore. Is that a good summary?
That's exactly what I've been writing for many years. In Greenspan's Fraud, that was my mantra. In the new book, The New Golden Age, also, that's my mantra. In fact, I've also always offered economic policies and economic reforms to correct these imbalances, but unfortunately, the wrong people are in power and they don't pay attention.
Right. So here's the question. Are we looking at a 1929-style crash? I mean, the big problem in 29 was a lack of liquidity. And right now, liquidity is being determined by and large by availability to credit. Are we looking at a liquidity crisis that could lead to something like the Great Depression?
The potential is certainly there that we could have another Great Depression, but I hope and pray that the government is more enlightened now and they would see that demand is the key to economic growth. So that's the way it was in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, until Reagan took over. They just distorted the economic picture and economic message. I think even now we could stop the debacle. But if they don't change their policies, then we think we are looking at a potential 1930s again.
Yeah, and Herbert Hoover, of course, the Republican president at the time of the Great Depression in 1929, refused essentially to do anything because he thought, you know, the market would correct itself, everything would be fine, just leave it to J.P. Morgan. Isn't that pretty much George Bush's perspective?
Well, no. George Bush is worse than that. George Bush says if the market is rising, don't do anything. If the market is falling, let's intervene. and that's what all the Wall Street people are now clamoring. They want the Fed intervention, they want the government intervention to stop the hemorrhaging in the stock market, but they didn't want anything like that when the markets were rising on the credit juggernaut.
Right.
So it's even worse than that.
We have less than a minute here before we just run out of time at the bottom of the hour. Ravi Batra, what should individuals do?
Well, an individual should save a lot of money. It's tough to do in these times, but that's what you have to do, save money.
Cash will be king.
And if you can afford it, buy some gold. If you can afford it, buy some foreign currencies because the U.S. dollar doesn't have much of a future. And I would sell into the rallies. Whenever there is a rally in the stock market, just sell or I'll get out of it, I think.
If you own stocks, get out of the market, in other words.
Yeah.
Ravi Batra, one of the best economists in this country, in my opinion. Ravi, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Martin.
Good talking with you. RaviBatra.com. You can go over to any of the websites, Amazon, any of the book sites, and check out his books. Some great writing. The New Golden Age, Greenspan's Fraud, and others. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you on Air America Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Well, bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Ooh. Yeah, yeah.
Well, 30 years ago, 30 years ago today, the king went into hiding to control the pigeon spies. Yep, that's my theory, and I'm sticking to it. We had two pigeon spies living near our house about a month ago, and now we have five pigeon spies, and they are all full-size pigeon spies. These are robots from the planet Xenon, I'm telling you. Anyway, so what's going on with the economy? Here's, and we're going to get to your calls in just a second, 866-303-2270. From today's Financial Times, just some startling headlines. Credit crunch hits Hollywood. The credit crunch shaking world markets has hit Hollywood after Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank, which were trying to raise over $1 billion to finance films for MGM, Milton Goldwyn Mayer, withdrew their commitment to underwrite the deal. The financing would have provided funds for films including The Hobbit, and MGM, the fourth installment of the Terminator franchise, and a new James Bond film. I mean, when you can't make a James Bond movie or a Terminator movie because you can't get credit, you know that there's a problem in the credit market. These are not risky investments, in my opinion. AAA double trouble. This is the point. Another article in the Financial Times. They're talking about Moody and Standard & Poor's and Moody's and Fitch's. And these three, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch's, and the credit rating institutions, they say on the one hand, they profit from a privileged status. U.S. laws and global Basel II capital rules, this is one of these big, international World Trade Organization kind of things, sanctify their ratings, operating margins above 50% of the result. In other words, they're making huge profits, for Moody's at any rate. Yet on the other hand, while they aim to act responsibly, the agents reject both liability and regulation, claiming the same constitutional free speech protection in the U.S. as much less profitable journalists have. And then, it just goes on and on. It's something to, frankly, be very concerned about. We've only been talking about it on this program for 5 years, everybody, oh, you're an alarmist. Trillions of dollars in debt, hundreds of billions of dollars in trade debt, over 14,000 American companies now sold off to foreign countries because we've had to borrow so much money from them. What are they going to do with all those dollars? Well, they come here and they buy us. Josh, driving in Kentucky. Hey, Josh, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to comment on a topic we were just talking about creating jobs and setting jobs, you know, overseas. I believe it was May 25th, Congress passed a bill to allow the Mexican truck drivers free range in the United States. I don't know.
I know, it's nuts.
I agree. A few things on that point. One, you know, with the way our trucking industry is so regulated by the federal government, you know, and the strict safety standards that are implied on truck drivers and the trucking companies, how does the federal government plan to regulate another country's trucking standards?
You know, to the best of my knowledge, they don't.
Right.
The Bushies don't believe in, or the Republicans, let's say, because we got to stop talking about the Bushies, because Bush is a lame duck and he's on the way out. And this is really, 100%, virtually 100% of the Republicans in Congress are behind this kind of stuff. So it's really this conservative / Republican strategy. They just don't believe in regulation. They think that's socialism. They think that's like the Soviet Union. It's a terrible thing. What? Safety standards? Hey, Ralph Nader, he's a communist. That's what they think. I'm serious.
The other thing I wanted to comment on that, you know, is your average company driver, I can't speak for an owner-operator because I'm not one, but as your average company driver makes about $40,000, $45,000, maybe $50,000 a year. Mm-hmm. You know, if you start letting these other Mexican truck drivers come up here and cut into that industry, that's going to drive down what an American truck driver makes, which in turn is going to, you know, cut his cost of living, which in turn is going to cut his ability to buy products that are, you know, a big part of the American economy.
Absolutely.
Now you figure there's 2 million truck drivers in the United States, you know, and at $40,000 a year, you know, I haven't done the math, but I mean, that's a lot of money that goes into the economy.
Yeah, that's a lot of buying power, and it's right across the board. And this is why labor unions are so important. This is why a strong minimum wage is so important. And this is why, frankly, I think the government as the employer of last resort is so important. It's one of the reasons why we need to be investing in infrastructure, because not only do we need the infrastructure, but it also creates jobs. I mean, right across the board, Josh, spot on and very well said. And thanks a lot for the call. I do appreciate it. Ralph in Laredo, Texas. Hey, Ralph.
Yeah, Tom, I've talked to you a couple times before. I was that farmer back in the 80s who wouldn't get off his farm there in Kansas.
Oh, yeah.
And, you're starting to see what I was talking about back then, 25
yep.
years ago.
Yeah, the 1980s was when Reagan just busted everything open and the family farms went down in flames, Willie Nelson out there trying to save folks, and nobody got it. This was Reaganomics, and it was ultimately, and most Americans were going, well, it's just the farmers. And no, it's gonna happen to you too someday.
Well, what they don't understand, when you go into the Article 8 and the Constitution on the coin and regulations of currency, this is counterfeit money they pumped in to do this to. Counterfeiting is where you create money out of thin air and put it into circulation, and it debunches the currency.
I agree, and that's one of the reasons.
Walmart and them were subsidized through these 401s on this unearned income poverty level stuff, where they go to work for these companies, they put their money in the 401, here comes a $5,000 check at the end of the year, they got a couple kids.
Yeah.
So they're creating these monopolies to destroy us.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And these Republicans, they believe in regulating the middle class and destroying them. Because, see, I've got a truck now, and see, they're all over us.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Now
they're getting down to where if you got a log fine, they want to make it a criminal charge, you show up in court or hire a lawyer to defend yourself against them.
Yeah. No, I got it, Ralph. And the destruction of the middle class is one of the things that is driving this economic disaster or this potential economic disaster. And I would say it's an economic disaster for the middle class right across the board. Front page story in today's Wall Street Journal about a family that can't afford to pay, you know, their ARM, their adjustable rate mortgages, kicking up in a few months, and their housing costs are going to go from $38,000 a year to $50,000 a year, and it's going to wipe them out. And there are millions of families like this who got these 2-year, adjusted rate mortgage, figuring that within 18 months they'd refinance it another, they'd just keep rolling it over at a lower rate and take out an extra $5,000 every time they do it. And now housing values are dropping and they can't do it. They can't do it. William in Long Beach, California. Hey, William, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing, man?
Fine. What's up?
Basically, what I was saying is that this is just the railroad just to, the Amero. As far as how I'm seeing it.
You mean a single currency for North America?
Yeah. Because basically, you know, this is how we're going to be sold, you know, as far as to, taking on this whole thing, you know?
Yeah, I really don't think so. I don't think that you're going to see a North American currency, and the reason why is because, A, I don't think Canada will go along with it, and, B, Mexico's economy is in such bad shape. I mean, without all the foreign funds coming into Mexico, Mexico's first largest source of income is oil. Their second largest source of income is money sent home by people who are in the United States working illegally. That's nothing to hold up an economy on, particularly when that second pillar is one that's pretty tenuous. I don't think that we're going to see a North American currency. And frankly, I don't think we're going to see a world currency. And here's why. Because the dollar has been the world currency to a certain extent and will continue to be to a certain extent, although the euro is very quickly eclipsing it. But the whole point here is that as the dollar crashes, countries all over the world, other countries, and it is crashing, by the way, countries all over the world are saying, we don't want to get in bed with these guys. They're crazy. They're running an $8 trillion deficit, budget deficit. You know, Reagan and Bush together, these two presidents have borrowed more than every other president in the history of the world combined. Well, Reagan accomplished that little trick just by himself, and now Bush has just about doubled it. And you go back to July of 06, a little more than a year ago, and here's an article, it's still archived over at theinformationclearinghouse.com, or .info, excuse me. And it's about a Kiplinger magazine article about Dick Cheney. And the article says, Cheney's betting on bad news. And it goes on to point out that he's socked away more than $25 million, and what's he doing with that money? He's dumped it in European bond funds. In other words, Dick Cheney, this was a little more than a year ago, was betting that the U.S. dollar was going to collapse. And sure enough, it has. If a year ago you had put your money into European bond funds, you would see right now almost a 30% increase in the value of your money, or really a decrease in the value of the dollar. You know, the point is that in 1800, with an ounce of gold, you could buy a good men's suit. In 1850, with an ounce of gold, you could buy a good men's suit. In 1900, with an ounce of gold, you could buy a good men's suit. You know, back, you know, when it was in 1950 with an ounce of gold, you could buy a good men's suit. And today with an ounce of gold, you could buy a good men's suit. The value of wealth has not changed. The value of the dollar has collapsed. John in Chandler, Arizona. Got to take a break in about a minute. John, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to thank you for enlightening me again. It's just always really good to listen to your show. And the things that I see that are similar to the crash in the 30s, is that Hoover was blind to what was really going on. And,
yeah.
And obviously, Bush is the same way. If you pay attention to Bush, you listen to what he says, and then you take the exact opposite position, more often than not, you're going to be right.
Well, that's what Cheney did. That's what Cheney did. Bush is saying the economy is going to be great, and Cheney says, no, I'm going to put my money in European bond funds.
Right.
And he's making out like a bandit. I remember, John, this is amazing. I remember back in the 80s, Gloria Swanson was on the board of directors of this program that I was the executive director of, a vegetarian community for abused kids up in New Hampshire. And I used to go down to New York about every 6 months, and we'd have dinner together. And she used to tell me these wild stories about Joe Kennedy and about life in the, you know, just before the big crash and when the crash happened, and about how all these guys, they all saw it coming. They all, or not all of them, most of them saw it coming. And then they got ready, 45 minutes past the hour.
The evidence is now clear. Industrial civilization has caused irreparable damage. Our political and corporate leaders have consistently ignored the overwhelming scientific evidence.
Not only is it the 11th hour, it's 11:59.
What we saw with Katrina is just prologue. Worse is yet to come.
The UN estimates that by the middle of the century, there may be 150 million environmental refugees.
There are too many of us using too many resources too fast.
The problem is that every living system is in decline, and the rate of decline is accelerating.
The tragedy is the potential extinction of humankind.
We face a convergence of crises, all of which are a concern for life.
And that a short clip from the movie The 11th Hour by Leonardo DiCaprio, who will be a guest on this program about 10:30 tomorrow morning Pacific time. What would that be? 1:30 Eastern time? 10, 11, 12, 1? Yeah, 1:30 Eastern time. And tomorrow, this afternoon, I'll be flying down to L.A. Tomorrow, I will be at the landmark in West L.A. for two screens, doing a Q&A after one and before the next, and then also at the Arclight in Hollywood for two screenings, after one and before the next in Los Angeles. The information's all over at our website, along with links to the theaters and where you can buy tickets at TomHartmann.com. Click on Tom's schedule, and it'll get you there. Also on Monday, I'll be in New York City at the Landmark Sunshine in the East Village. Same thing, doing a Q&A after the before and after screening. And on the 21st in New York, screening Liberally at the Tank. And on August 24th in San Francisco, we'll keep you up to date on all that stuff. But anyhow, that's what's coming up. The White House doesn't want Petraeus to testify publicly on Iraq, the big headline right now on Huffington Post. This is a story we're going to dig into a little bit more in our third hour, but just wanted to give you a heads up. They've 6 months, a year now? Oh, when Petraeus speaks, we'll listen. Well, now they don't want him to speak. It's amazing. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Carlos in West Orange, New Jersey. Hey, Carlos, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine. What's up?
I was going over the mortgage things and all of the rates and all that stuff.
Hmm.
What happened is I bought this house, my house that I'm in, 10 years ago. And I think about 7 years ago I refinanced because I had like an adjustable rate.
Mm-hmm.
I refinanced to a fixed rate 20 years.
Very smart.
Right. And it started out when I refinanced, I had my mortgage was like $1,300. From that point to this point, 7 years later, my mortgage has gone up to about $1,500, a little over $1,550. Now, it's not no adjustable rate, no nothing. It's just the taxes and the insurance.
Oh, it's because your property taxes and insurance are rolled into your mortgage payment. This is one of the big things that nobody is talking about on the right, and that is that they're all running around about we've got to cut income taxes on the rich, on the millionaires and billionaires, and they don't point out that when they cut those income taxes at the top end of the tax bracket, somebody has to pay some taxes in order to maintain infrastructure and keep the country going.
Exactly.
And more that's being thrown onto property taxes and local, state, county, town, township, city, municipal taxes. And you're absolutely right, spot on right, Carlos. And who gets whacked? Guess who? The middle class, of course. James in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, James, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I wanted to let you know that I spotted a couple of those pigeons.
From the planet Xenu?
Yes. And one of them had been run over by an automobile, and another one run over by a train, and they both had their little diodes squished.
Okay. So originally, I thought you were calling to contradict my theory that the pigeons are all robots in the planet Xenu, because they aren't actually pigeons. They're actually chickens that, baby chickens, half-grown chickens that have been dressed up to look like pigeons. They do that occasionally for the occasional dead pigeon. But really, nobody's ever seen a dead pigeon or a baby pigeon, and that's how you know that they're all robots.
Well,
James,
that's more of your theory that I've been trying to check out. And the one still had his little diode squished, and he was still smoking. So I was just checking. I'm keeping up on you, Tom.
All righty. Thanks a lot, James. Good to hear from you. Steve in L.A. Hey, Steve.
Tom, a couple of comments. First, I really appreciate all that you've been doing to educate the American people as to the structural flaws in our economic system. Your book, Screwed, is just an unbelievably erudite exposition of the structural problems with the disappearing middle class, and I thank you for it. I wanted to ask your opinion. In a culture such as ours, which places so much value and spends so much time and money on entertainment, is it possible, do you think, or likely, for the American people to finally awaken to the economic realities and start dealing with structural problems such as a capitalist system, such as the finest Congress that money can buy, and finally, such as a court system that protects property of interests and says to heck with the middle class and to heck with the little guy?
Yeah, I do think it's possible, Steve. And for I'm sorry, your phone's making a lot of noise here, but you can pick me up on the air there. The for the 5 years that I've been doing this radio program, I've been talking about this a lot. And what I've been saying is I see this coming, and we can stop it if we change our economic policies. And there was no consensus. I mean, you know, supply-side economics and right-wing economics and Milton Friedman, Tom Friedman, Chicago School, insanity has ruled. And so, you know, my fallback position, which I've been saying for 5 years on this program, is, and if Americans don't get it, and we don't change things with our political system, then it's going to take an economic shock. And God forbid it should be as bad as the Great Depression, because a lot of people died. A lot of people's lives were made very, very miserable by the Great Depression. But it's going to take some kind of major economic shock to waken people out of their complacency. And millions of people being thrown out of their homes, millions of people being wiped out right after the banks and the moneyed interests in this country said, oh, we're going to change the bankruptcy laws so you no longer, you know, forget about declaring bankruptcy. You're in trouble now. You know, I think that shock is here. And I think people are starting to pay attention to these issues, and they're starting to go, oh, you mean I should pay attention to things like wages and productivity? I didn't even know what those words meant. Yes, you should know what those words meant. Up next, the CEO of Kaiser.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. You're tuned into the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back. What do we do about health care in America? 1947, Harry Truman proposed a national health insurance program, a single-payer system. It was shot down by the Republicans, who at that time controlled the House and the Senate as a result of the election of 46, and never really resurfaced again. There have been a lot of proposals out there. It seems like every candidate for president has a different one. And now comes one from what some may consider an unlikely source in the form of a new book, Healthcare Reform Now, the title of the book, subtitle A Prescription for Change, authored by George Halverson. George Halverson was named chairman and chief executive officer of the Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, Inc., and the Kaiser Foundation Hospitals, headquartered in Oakland, California, in 2002. Kaiser Permanente is the nation's largest integrated health plan, serving more than 8.4 million members in 9 states and the District of Columbia. And Mr. Halverson has more than 30 years' experience in the healthcare management field. George Halverson, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on the air.
Tell us what your prescription. I think we all agree the system is broken, and the analysis in the book is a fairly cogent one. What's your prescription? How do we fix this?
Well, we basically need to cover two things. We need to cover everyone in America. We are the only industrialized country that doesn't cover every single one of its citizens. And we need to step up to the plate and bite the bullet to make that happen. It's not only an issue of inequity for the uninsured, but it's particularly an issue of inequity for racial minorities. Right now, 75% of the uninsured in California come from minority groups. So I think it's an issue of racial discrimination as well as an issue of just bad health.
Well, and there's an economic competitive issue as well.
Issue. We're running at costs that are hugely higher than other countries in the world, and we are not getting as good of health care outcomes in many cases. And so what I'm basically arguing in the book is that it's time to reform the actual delivery of health care in America, that we need to identify the areas where the healthcare delivery system is not performing. And we know it's not performing for our patients with chronic conditions. And our patients with chronic conditions incur 70% of our healthcare cost. So we do a lousy job. We take care for diabetics. We do it right barely half the time. And we need to take that half the time, move it up to 90% or better of doing it right, because we need to reduce complications. We need to reduce the amputations. We need to reduce the blindness. And if we deliver appropriate care, as I point out in the book, and it's not that hard to do, if we deliver systematically appropriate care, we can reduce the cost of care, improve the quality of care, and at the same time, cover everyone.
Is Kaiser doing this?
Kaiser is doing care improvement in each of those areas. And one of the reasons Kaiser just invested, we actually invested $3 billion in putting an automated medical record system in place We're 90% through with that process. And the reason we're doing that is because we know even in a vertically integrated system like ours, where we own the clinics and we own the hospitals, we can't do it as well as we need to do it unless we have computer support for the caregivers.
Is Kaiser a for-profit or a not-for-profit corporation?
Not-for-profit.
It's not-for-profit. I remember, well, so in a way, you could argue that what you have with Kaiser is pretty much identical to socialized medicine, except it's run by a non-profit corporation rather than by a government. Would that be an
accurate? Well, the Kaiser model, it's interesting. The Kaiser model looked an awful lot like the Swedish and Norwegian models of healthcare in Europe. If you go to Europe, Europe has a wide range of models. The Swiss are entirely private sector. Everybody in Switzerland has an individual mandate, and they all join private health plans.
Well, actually, it's not entirely. There is a government system in Switzerland for the poor.
But well, actually, what they do is they subsidize coverage, I think, for their very low-income people. But it's a very small. In the Netherlands, has what you just said. They have a private, they have a system for low-income people. It's a government system, and they have a private sector. And the other end of the continuum is Sweden. Sweden basically employs the doctors, owns the hospitals, and has teams of caregivers working together. And frankly, the Swedish care system performs at a very high level. Kaiser and some Swedish hospitals actually learn from each other regularly.
Yeah. Now, we have a situation in the United States where we've got people like Bill McGuire, who was the CEO of UnitedHealthcare, the second largest health insurance company in the United States, who took home a paycheck, well, total compensation last year when he left, of $1.78 billion. And this is for a company that did not deliver any health care. It simply administered the delivery of health care. It seems to me that we have a profoundly broken system, and a large chunk of it is the profit motive in it. I remember as a kid in the 50s and 60s, you know, we had Blue Cross Blue Shield in Michigan. My dad, you know, worked in a tool and die shop and, you know, good union job, and we always had Blue, and it was a nonprofit. It was required by law to be a nonprofit corporation. Are you suggesting that we should be, if not involving the government in a much larger way, at least involving taking the profit motive out of healthcare in the United States and letting nonprofit organizations play a larger role? Or are you an advocate of the so-called free market system of let's let more William McGuire's make more billions off the rest of us?
Well, what I did with the book was ignore that particular issue entirely and focus instead on the fact that we have an epidemic in this country of diabetes, we have an epidemic of asthma, and we do a really lousy job of taking care of our kids with asthma. So what I say in the book is, we need to improve asthma care. We need to set goals for asthma care. We need to figure out what the tools are. We need to put them in place. And if we don't do that systematically, those care improvements will never happen. They're not going to happen by individual doctors reading an article someplace and coming up with a better care treatment. So what I'm focusing on in the book is, what do we need to do to transform the care delivery system in America to get it to the right outcome? I have another chapter. I have one chapter in the book that talks about universal coverage. And in that chapter, what I basically say is, let's expand Medicaid to cover all the poor, not just the poor who happen to have kids. Let's expand SCHIP significantly. Let's put programs in place to subsidize care for the low-income people. And let's put in a system that looks a lot like the Netherlands, because I don't think it's possible. I think the Kaiser Permanente model is a wonderful model. I think when we have hospitals, doctors, all the caregivers in the same system, we can do things that other people can't do. But I think it's really hard to get the rest of American healthcare to that model. So what I'm suggesting in the book, sort of, is that the rest of healthcare organize along the lines of becoming a virtual Kaiser, become accountable, become transparent, and be patient-focused. But the major reform I'm talking about in the book, though, is reforming the delivery of care itself. And then we can wrestle as a secondary issue. And I suggest an infrastructure to do that. As a secondary issue, we can wrestle with whether or not that infrastructure ought to be for-profit or not-for-profit.
And how we fund it.
And how we fund it. But we definitely need to improve care delivery in those areas.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. But what I would predict is that, given the nature of the political process, that how we fund it and who owns it are going to be the two things that are first argued in Congress, because there's ideology associated with those two perspectives.
I think there's some likelihood of that, but I also think that if we go to Congress and say to Congress, we are doing an incredibly bad job of taking care of our diabetics in this country. There are actually less than 10% of the diabetics get all of the care they need. And it's the fastest growing disease in the country. 32% of all the money spent by Medicare is spent on diabetics. instead of focusing on improving the care for the diabetics, we're focusing on other issues relative to Medicare, like denying some people eligibility. Well, I think denying eligibility is one end of the continuum. Improving care and cutting costs is the other end. I think we should be focusing on the improving care side. And the opportunities are there. There's some low-hanging fruit that we could harvest. But what we have to have is we have to have a focus on the part of Congress on significantly improving care. And then they have to have the courage to bite the bullet and create the kinds of databases and the data support necessary to track whether or not we're doing that.
Yeah, we're talking with George.
If they have that courage, they could do it.
Right. We're talking with George Halverson, the chairman and CEO of Kaiser Permanente, healthreformnow.org, the website, his new book, Healthcare Reform Now. Sir, we have just a little less than a minute left. Your prescription seems to me a lot like the Massachusetts model. And in fact, you talk about the Massachusetts model on your website. It's new. It's just started. How's it working?
I think it's new and it's just started. And you're right. There are some elements, but only elements in my universal coverage piece that resemble Massachusetts. What Massachusetts doesn't do is focus on the kinds of healthcare delivery improvements that I'm talking about. They are talking about, in a sort of passive way, identifying some medical best practices. And I'm saying that's totally inadequate. We can't just identify medical best practices and send out a memo. What we have to do is figure out what we need done for every asthmatic. What's the right diagnosis? What's the right treatment? What's the right follow-up? What's the right monitoring? And then make sure that happens. Because asthma is costing a huge amount of money in this country, and we're delivering care very badly. We could cut the number of hospital admissions by 50 to 90% if we delivered asthma care appropriately. And somebody needs to bite that bullet. The Massachusetts model doesn't do that. What they do is they basically say, if you ask, we will give you advice on what to do with an asthma patient. And the system doesn't ask.
What
we need to do is we need focus. We need to identify where the real areas of opportunity are in care improvement, and then we need to make those opportunities happen.
Okay. George Halverson, the healthreformnow.org, the website, the book Healthcare Reform Now. Interesting analysis and a fascinating book. Thank you very much for being with us today.
It's good to be here.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. See, I think this is really a symptom, or not, a symptom is perhaps the wrong word, but it's a sign, let's say, that the times are changing. When you've got the CEO of, you know, one of the largest healthcare providers in the country coming out and saying, we need universal healthcare right now. Now, you know, I'm certainly not here to portray George Halverson or Kaiser as a saint or as a flawless institution. And in fact, Michael Moore goes after him with some vehemence in his book, in his movie Sicko. And that said, I think it's a sign of the times that you have somebody like this coming out and saying, you know, it's time for universal health care. What I thought was particularly interesting is that he was not willing to address in the book, or frankly in our interview on the air, the issue of how do you pay for it and who owns it. And as I said, those are going to be the issues. The how do you deliver it, that's all going to come later. But, for example, this story from CNN. A man threw his seriously ill wife four stories to her death because he could no longer afford to pay for her medical care, prosecutors said, in charging him with second-degree murder. According to court documents filed Wednesday in Jackson County Circuit Court, Stanley Reimer walked his wife to the balcony of their apartment and kissed her goodbye before throwing her over. The body of Christy Reimer, 47, was found Tuesday night outside the apartment building near the upscale Country Club Plaza shopping district. In a probable cause statement filed with the charges, police said Reimer was desperate because he could not pay the bills for his wife's treatment for neurological problems and uterine cancer. She had no health insurance. Documents listed her assets as approximately $6,700 with a monthly income of $725 from Social Security. I mean, this is not a rich family. And, you know, I'm not in any way defending what he did. But it's just like, this is how bad it's gotten in America. This is one symptom of how bad it has gotten in America. I mean, it is a true tragedy. And I think it's such a good thing that we have all of the Democratic candidates now calling for universal health care. Dennis Kucinich out there just saying, bang, right out of the gate, single-payer health care. Medicare for all. We already have a single-payer health care system in the United States. It's called Medicare. If everybody in the United States automatically had it, as Dennis Kucinich is suggesting, or as John Edwards suggests, if everybody in America could buy into it, and the cost would be a fraction of what normal health insurance costs, because there's no $1 billion paycheck for the CEO of Medicare. There is no CEO. It's just, you know, government bureaucrats with green eye shades doing their work for a government paycheck. It's like Social Security. I mean, your total administrative costs are 1, 2, 3%. It's nothing. And so if everybody in America could buy into Social Security, or if employers could buy into Social Security and offer it to all of their employees, or both, or if everybody was simply covered by by Medicare, or if everybody in the country was simply covered by Medicare, with a $200 to $300 increase in overall in taxes, compared to the $11,000 a year on average all of us are paying, whether we have health insurance or not, for the costs of medical care in the United States. Of course, you'd put out of business a whole lot of for-profit, particularly health insurance companies in the middle, and you could have health insurance for everybody. So we have a single-payer system in the United States. It's called Medicare for All. And as John Edwards pointed out on this program a month or so ago, if we were to allow anybody to buy into Medicare, pretty soon all the health insurance companies would be out of business because they can't compete. They just can't compete. Or they could compete, but they wouldn't be able to pay dividends to their stockholders. They wouldn't be able to pay multi-million dollar salaries to their CEOs and top officers. They wouldn't be able to afford the corporate jets, the gold-plated bathroom faucets, and the whole bit. I mean, you know, they'd have to go away. And I'd say, goodbye! Fine thing! We also have in the United States a socialized medicine program. It's called the Veterans Administration, where the government owns the hospitals and runs the hospitals. And no, that's not what was going on at Bethesda. That's actually the Department of Defense. That's the Pentagon's health program, which arguably is also socialized. But the Veterans Administration's hospital system is socialized medicine. And the biggest problem that they have is underfunding. And why do they have underfunding? Because veterans don't represent such a large voting bloc that they're able to move Congress. If all of us had access to the VA system, or if the VA system were to take over all of the hospitals and all of the care in the United States, so you had socialized medicine in the United States, then just like with a single-payer program where you have private but not-for-profit organizations offering services and the government simply writing the check, either one of those systems, if all of us are invested in it, if all of us have a stake in that game, then our politicians who are making the decisions about the funding, they're going to have to respond to us. I mean, it's democracy 101, and it works in various forms and various ways in countries all over the world, in the industrialized countries all over the world. You really want to learn about this issue, go check out Michael Moore's movie, Sicko. I know it's still playing in a lot of theaters, and it's really a great movie. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
A little bit of guitar, a little bit of truck, a little bit of hound dog, and a little bit of luck. A little bit of bacon, a little bit of beans, a little bit of you loving up on me. A little bit of how it's supposed to be, a little bit of life.
And how it should be is health care for everybody in the United States of America. You know, the right to life, to borrow a phrase, really should be a right. Healthcare should be a right. We need to acknowledge that the United States Constitution, and certainly the Declaration of Independence, which talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that the Constitution that talks about the general welfare of the people, that what that means is the right, not the privilege, the right to have healthcare, as is the case in every other industrialized country in the world. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, Janet, Long Beach, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Janet.
Hi. Yes, I'm one of those people that
found out that they weren't eligible for Social Security when they turned 65. Mm-hmm. Fell through the cracks, wasn't married 10 years, and wasn't employed long enough, although I'm... But the details are that I do pay into Social Security so that I can get Medicare, and it costs me about $572 a month, and it's the best deal I can get.
Yeah, that's about half of what Louise and I were paying when we lived in Vermont and had private health insurance, just for the two of us. I mean,
really? Yeah, well, I had private health insurance, but that was a lot less. But when you turn 65, I had Kaiser, and I was getting a pretty good deal. But when you're 65, it goes, this is a couple of years ago, it went up to $700 a month.
Yeah.
So paying $572 a month to Social Security, it might be more with Kaiser now.
Well, see, that's the thing. Social Security is cheaper than any of these programs because it has virtually no overhead. I mean, the administrative costs are minimal. It's operated out of government buildings that we're all collectively paying for, the part of the commons already. Medicare. And I just think that everybody in America should be able to be covered by Medicare. It should be a really simple thing.
Uh-huh.
Janet, thank you for sharing your story with us. Steve in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Steve.
Hey, actually, Lansing, New York.
Oh, I'm sorry, Lansing, New York.
And I did change my first name because I am a healthcare provider and I want to be anonymous. Your heart is in the right place, and I wish I could be a guest on your show as a healthcare provider to comment, but I'm going to tell you.
I'm going to
fly through this. First of all, Kaiser Permanente is not very friendly to medical whistleblowers. How do I know that? One of my close friends whistleblew over there and he got crushed. Mm. His career got crushed. Number two, non-for-profit. Did you ask Halverson how much he was making or any of the administrators for those non-for-profit type corporations or whatever? They make money. They don't make $20,000 a year. Number three.
No, well, my understanding is that my understanding is that his last job he was making like $800,000 a year and that his salary here is not disclosed, but it's probably in that neighborhood. I mean, Liddy Dole was making $500,000 a year as the head of the Red Cross.
I understand.
Some nonprofits are paying well, but that's nothing compared to $1.8 billion.
$800,000 is more than probably 10 people make, you know, in a year.
Certainly in the Medicare department. Yeah.
$800,000 a year. The other thing is that it hasn't been brought up. It is a huge thing. He talks about asthmatics. He talks about people with, you know, different chronic medical conditions. There are people that walk around that don't take their blood sugar. There are people, many, this isn't an isolated thing. There are people that don't take care of themselves and cause a huge, huge glut, and it is in the hundreds of billions of dollars per year in our system, and it's one of the reasons why we don't have universal health care, and none of the politicians want to talk about it because it's not pretty. Not pretty to talk about.
Yeah,
okay.
And then there's even the causal stuff. Like, for example, is a large part of this obesity epidemic, which is leading to the diabetes epidemic, caused by things like corn syrup?
People need to take better care of themselves too.
Well, of course, but and people will take care of themselves based on the information that they have. What is the big difference between 1960, when almost nobody was obese, and 2006, when fully a third of America is obese? What's the big difference? Is it that all of a sudden we got irresponsible? I don't think so. I frankly think it has to do with our food supply.
Ask 100 people that have diabetes that know that they should be on a diabetic diet and are not. It's not that simple of an answer. It is not.
No, I'm not disagreeing with that point, and I'm saying that there are societal forces at work here that are as large or larger than the individual forces, and it's very easy to simply blame the victims.
Your heart is in the right place. But in order to fix this system, it's going to take actual people taking care of themselves, too.
Okay. Point made, Steve. Thanks a lot for the call. Ken in San Pedro, California. Hey, Ken.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate you zeroing in on just the basic philosophy of the problem with for-profit healthcare. Like your guest, I think it was yesterday, was talking about he would like to see, you know, different systems compete. You know, capitalistic systems the care is better when there's competition among the different systems and that sort of thing. And I just want to say that. Most systems that operate for profit don't sit around and say, how can we deliver the best service at the cheapest cost? Seems to me it's just the opposite. How can we deliver less and get more money for it?
Right. It's how can we maximize profits and minimize expenses?
Yeah, exactly. They sit around, their boards sit around. They don't talk about how can we take less, or how can we pay our employees more. No, they sit around and talk about how can we pay our employees less and deliver less and get more profit. See, that's
right. Nonprofit corporations. I'm on the board of a nonprofit corporation and have been for almost 30 years. I agree with you. And the contrast that I want to draw is that with nonprofits, when we have our board meetings for the New England Salem Children's Village or the Hunter School up in New Hampshire, the question on the table is always, are we providing these kids with the services that they need? Is the standard of care as good as it can get? Is there anything that we can do to improve it? It's not how can we figure out a way to squeeze an extra $30 a month out of each one of our employees so we can put that money in our pocket, because nobody on our board of directors is even paid.
Exactly. It's just a basic philosophical difference in for-profit systems. It's always the case that they're going to either cut back on medical supplies or pay their employees less. That's just the driving force. And you pointed out with your interviewer today, he didn't want to go there. He would not go there. He wanted to direct it to, let's deliver better health care rather than...
Right. And we do need a discussion in this country about how to deliver better health care. But who's going to own the health care system and how it's going to be funded are, in my mind, the most important questions. And very few people want to talk about that. The only ones that I hear talking about it in a really serious and meaningful way are Dennis Kucinich and John Edwards, frankly. Let's see here. Helen in Fremont, California. You wanted to comment about Kaiser?
Yes, I did. I wish I had been able to speak to Mr. Halverson. I wrote him a letter, as a former caller said. The rates, the co-payments went up from 3 years ago from $5 to last year $10 and this year $30. And my husband and I are senior citizens, and we've spent over $600 in co-payments the last 5 weeks.
I understand, Helen. And Kaiser's not alone in that. In fact, I find myself in a very awkward position here defending, you know, Kaiser and Halverson when I really have, you know, no interest in defending either one of them and no personal knowledge of either one of them. But the fact of the matter is that the system is broken, and at least as a nonprofit, I think that they're less toxic than some of these hugely for-profit organizations. I mean, talk to the folks who are paying in to the hospital system that Bill Frist's family owns, that made his father one of the Fortune 500 billionaires in the United States. He's worth $5 billion as a result of squeezing money out of mostly elderly people in the central United States. Starting in Tennessee by taking county hospitals, municipal hospitals that were not for profit and flipping them for profit, and then squeezing the blood out of everything. So, you know, your point is taken, and I'm sorry to hear about your circumstances, and it just again highlights the importance of real, true change in the United States. We really need to get to that. Dan at Stanford University, or David, excuse me, David at Stanford. Hey, David.
Yeah, hi, Tom. David Kearns. You know, I listened to the interview with Mr. Halverson, and I certainly do respect the Kaiser organization, and it's hard to argue with what he says about quality. But really, his book and his comments don't address what's at the heart of the matter, which is lack of insurance and cost. Yeah. And, you know, Kaiser is a vertically integrated organization, but if you tease out its insurance component, it's just like all the other private insurance companies. And if we look at Medicare with their 2-3% overhead and private insurance with its 20-30% overhead, we still have the same problem. And, you know, in a $2 trillion healthcare economy, that adds up to $200-300 billion a year in unnecessary overhead. I mean, you've said over and over again that health insurance companies don't deliver a moment of care to a single person. And that's still true for the Kaiser insurance component.
Yeah. Well, again, I don't want to make this a referendum on Kaiser. I understand your point, and well taken. But it's not about Kaiser. This is about a broken system that absolutely transcends any one individual company. Timothy in Memphis, Tennessee. Thanks for the call. Timothy in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Timothy.
Yeah, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Good. Tom, this has to do with the health of American democracy, which has something to do with the health of our bodies and minds. I wanted to counter a characterization of Karl Rove very briefly.
Okay.
And Rove's sole capability is based on the lowest form of intellectual manipulation.
Yep. Timothy, you're fading out. I agree with you. It is the lowest form of manipulation. It's using fear. This is the big thing that we in America need to do now. Whether it's with regard to health care or the war in Iraq or Karl Rove or anything else, we need to stand up and say, we're not afraid anymore. And we're not going to be made afraid anymore. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program. On AirAmericaRadio.com.
The evidence is now clear. Industrial civilization has caused irreparable damage. Our political and corporate leaders have consistently ignored the overwhelming scientific evidence.
Not only is it the 11th hour, it's 11:59.
What we saw with Katrina is just prologue. Worse is yet to come.
The UN estimates that by the middle of the century, there may be 150 million environmental refugees.
There are too many of us using too many resources too fast.
The problem is that every living system is in decline, and the rate of decline is accelerating.
The tragedy is the potential extinction of humankind.
We face a convergence of crises, all of which are a concern for life.
At a piece of the trailer of the 11th hour, I'll be in L.A. for the screenings of it, the opening of it tomorrow, and we'll be doing the show live from K-Talk tomorrow morning, in New York on Monday, in San Francisco on Friday of next week. And all of it is over, my schedule anyway, my part of it is over at TomHartman.com. Click on, and you'll find the trailer for the movie up at the very top, plus links to 11thHour.com, 11thHourFilm.com, and the 11thHourAction.com, sites where you can participate, where you can do things about, you know, what's happening with the planet. And if you click on my schedule, you'll get all the information on where I'm going to be and when and all that kind of thing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, one more .com there, online with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, Gordon, John Rowe, who did the gaggle this morning for the White House press corps in Texas, denied that Petraeus would not testify openly, said that there were no truths to the rumors that they tried to lobby to get Petraeus to testify only in a congressional committee. So that's the White House's report, response to the report that, of course, they were trying to get things behind the scenes. Now, it's also, and of course, the newspapers stand by their story. So it's interesting, the White House also said that participating in this report that is going to be written essentially by Petraeus, but it's really being written by the White House, will be Secretary Gates and Secretary Rice's view of Iraq. Now, I don't know how Secretary Rice really has an understanding of Iraq, but hey, not Secretary.
Well, she's the Secretary of State. You would think that she has some sense of what's going on.
But I don't think she's, in terms of boots on the ground kinds of things.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. She may have a political
I mean, you know, her entire, unlike in many ways, I guess, when she was the head of Stanford, but it seems like her entire thing has been, her entire role in the Bush administration has been basically to rubber stamp whatever George Bush says.
Exactly, yes. So. That obviously, if she's having a hand in this, and this Admiral Fallon and the White House National Security staff is really going to be putting this together.
Yeah. So Tony Snow now says he's going to resign. This at the top of thinkprogress.org. Apparently, he was on the Hugh Hewitt show, and he said he's not going to be around until the end of the term.
Well, I think his health is a primary concern.
Yeah, that's right. But there's just a whole bunch of people. He said probably a couple in the next month or so, probably a couple more coming in the next month or so of resignations.
My guess is that we're looking at probably early September for Tony. That's
yeah,
my guess.
Interesting.
And he didn't give
now,
it, but that would be, I honestly, as you know, Tony Snow is a good friend of mine, and he's a colleague, and I knew him before he became a spokesperson. Yeah, he's a conservative, but I think he's a great guy. But I don't know how you do this with the amount of kids he's got, who, you know, who are preteen and teenagers, and his health problems, and trying to do what he has to do at the White House every day. I
don't know how he can walk out there and deliver this the BS that he's delivering and sleep at night.
Because he's a believer.
Yeah, well.
Tony, though, is a believer.
Yeah, well, that's all the more. Yeah, I that's the thing. You would have to be, and that's, you know, I guess it's all the more the tragedy. It's he's a believer in a very bizarre religion of conservatism that just increasingly the rest of America makes no sense, and apparently makes little sense to a federal appeals court. One of the judges, the lawsuits about the program where AT&T is providing the NSA with customer phone and internet communications, and this program disclosed by the New York Times that the so-called terrorist surveillance program where the NSA bypasses court warrants in monitoring international communications involving people in the United States, and the Bush administration came in and said that the court should give utmost deference. To the government and basically should not ask, you know, any questions. It's a state secret. And one of the judges says, the government's argument is tantamount to saying the king can do no wrong.
Well, that's right. You've got a Ninth Circuit court opinion. This is going to go, it's not an opinion at this point because I don't think they've issued their final statement, but you can bet it's going to go all the way to the Supreme Court. Now, as bad as the Supreme Court is, 5-4, I am not sure that they are going to go for all this government surveillance. Because if they're truly conservatives, and I believe that Scalia is a true conservative, I'm not sure they're going to go with that.
Scalia doesn't believe in democracy. You know, he's given speeches saying that democracy is a terrible thing.
But I would find it...
It seems to me Kennedy would be the swing vote on this thing, not Scalia.
Maybe, but I just find it hard to believe that they would give the government that kind of power. I even the worst conservatives.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. Any sense of when this court case may be resolved?
Well, no, because they have to issue their opinion, and then it'll be appealed. And the question is whether it gets sort of fast-tracked through the Supreme Court and heard this next session or whether it would be another final year.
Yeah. And finally, the Congressman Bill Sally, the Republican from Idaho, is trashing Keith Ellison and anybody else who's not Christian in the government, saying that this government was founded on Christian principles.
Well, listen, I had a member of Congress, and I forgot his name, but he is the congressman from Midland, Texas area, tell me that, you know, I would most likely go to hell because I didn't believe in Jesus Christ as my personal savior.
Because you're Jewish.
Yeah.
Amazing. A congressman telling you that. I mean,
yeah.
It's, well, you know, I guess, you know, as an individual, but amazing. Ellen Ratner, thanks so much for being with us, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
The feminists are coming! Yes, they are. Jessica Valencia is with us, the author of Full Frontal Feminism. She's also the founder and executive editor of Feministing.com on the web. Hey, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. The subtitle of your book, A Young Woman's Guide to Why Feminism Matters, which the subtitle immediately provokes two questions. Number one, why young women? And number two, obviously, why feminism matters?
Well, I think with young women, the problem is that so many young women support feminist values, but they're just so afraid to call themselves feminists because of all of the anti-feminist stereotypes out there. So I wanted to write a book that really reached out to them, and obviously I think feminism matters for all sorts of great reasons.
Yeah. So it seems to me that with many movements, there's an arc that you see where the movement starts out outside the mainstream, mm-hmm. the movement becomes a substantial outside the mainstream movement. The movement then becomes incorporated into the mainstream.
becomes co-opted and commercialized, is now has five glossy magazines competing with each other, and everybody tries to market to people who were in the movement. The movement is now hip, and it's no longer a movement. It's now just another consumer niche. Right. And very often at that point, its core values have been diluted to the point where it's where they're no longer really recognizable. It's become a caricature of itself. And it seems to me, you know, kind of standing on the outside of this, but having watched this for the, you know, for the probably 35 years or so of the 50 some odd years of my life, that feminism has gone through that arc largely since the 60s. Do you think that my analysis has any accuracy to it? And if so, how do you bring it back out of the mainstream, out of being a consumer product, basically, and into a movement?
Well, you know, I agree with you, but I don't know necessarily that it's really feminists that have made it into that, you know, brought it into that consumer realm. I think that feminism has been appropriated for consumer reasons. You know, you'll see anyone
Absolutely.
From the Pussycat Dolls to, you know, the stripping classes saying that they're feminists and, you know, using feminist language and using feminist rhetoric. But that's not feminists who are doing that, of course. You know, that's the mainstream culture appropriating it. But I think at its core, the feminist values are still the same. You know, women are still doing the same work that they were 30 years ago. It's just a matter of how much people are seeing it.
Let's define those values then.
Sure. Well, I mean, I define feminism in the book really simply as, you know, the belief that women should have equal political, economic, and social equality. And I think I do that because it's kind of a hard thing to argue with, you know.
I believe that it was I don't remember the year, but wasn't it Ted Kennedy who put forward the Equal Rights Amendment over and over and over again, and every year it failed to get...
They're still trying to do the ERA in certain states, and I mean the same people who are fighting it back then are fighting it now, if you can believe that.
And the Equal Rights Amendment is one sentence. Yeah, I don't have it memorized, do you?
I don't. It's, you know, it's just, you know, one sentence about, you know, you can't discriminate against someone because of their sex. And it's amazing to me that something so simple could be so considered so controversial.
Yeah, and it's what's amazing to me is that all these years after the Civil Rights Movement, and now that's, you know, obviously we don't have even racial equality in the United States, but still, you know, it went mainstream. After all these years,
yeah.
That the Equal Rights Amendment is even considered controversial is mind-boggling to me.
Well, you know, it's one of those things. Feminism just really rubs people the wrong way. It's one of those things, like, you'll still see so much of the anti-feminist stereotypes out there still. You know, the same stereotypes that were there 30 years ago are still there now. You know, the bra-burning thing, for example, never happened, not true. But, you know, you ask a young person what they think about feminism, that's probably one of the first things they're going to say.
Right. Yeah. And it doesn't help, you know, Limbaugh and his bunch with the feminazis and all this kind of stuff. Tell us about feministing.com.
Feministing.com is a blog that I started about 3 years ago because I felt like younger women's voices weren't necessarily being heard in the larger mainstream movement. So, you know, most of the women who write there are younger women. Most of our readers are younger women. And it's just a great place where people can come and talk and write.
Right. And what are the biggest challenges that... Well, let me rephrase that.
Sure.
If the feminist movement, to the extent that there is an identifiable feminist movement in the United States right now, has specific goals, what are they?
Well,
beyond the broad one that you identified of equality, I mean, what are the milestones? How do you accomplish that?
Well, I mean, I think obviously there's a lot of work being done right now in the mainstream feminist movement on reproductive rights, which have been, you know, rolled back so far under the Bush administration. But I think kind of newer, well, not newer, but more trendy topics that are coming up right now is, you know, are childcare, work-life issues. And violence against women, unfortunately, is still a huge problem that feminists are still working on. But, you know, what's really interesting and great is that a lot of the feminist activism that's going on is not necessarily in those national mainstream movements. It's in small organizations on the ground. It's in local communities. And there, you know, people are really defining for themselves what the important issues are on a community basis.
We're talking with Jessica Valenti. She's the author of Full Frontal Feminism, A Young Woman's Guide to Why Feminism Matters, and also runs the blog, the website, feministing.com. And you were talking about groups around the country. To what extent is the feminist movement organized in the United States? And if so, what's the structure of the organization?
Oh my goodness, what an intense question. Well, I mean, I think that you have, you know, all of the big national organizations like NOW and Feminist Majority Foundation, and those are really the folks that, you know, that started stuff back in the day, and they're really, you know, in DC, on the Hill, making stuff happen. But the kind of feminism I'm interested in right now and that a lot of younger women are doing is, like I said before, is on the ground, is local organizing. And I think that's kind of the most exciting kind of feminism that's going on, and I think that's really going to be the future of feminist activism, that and online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great stuff. Well, let me just recommend the book, and thank you so much for being with us. Full Frontal Feminism, Young Woman's Guide to Why Feminism Matters, Feministine.com, the website. Jessica Valenti, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Great talking with you. 13 minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Sean in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Sean, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Tom, I wanted to recommend to you and your listeners the PBS series Nova did a program on long-term capital management, that hedge fund back in 1998.
Right.
And Nova actually did an excellent program on the subject called The Trillion Dollar Bet. I was able to get it at WGBH Boston's website.
Uh-huh.
But they go into great detail about these, what they call quantitative funds, and I'm not making this up. Some people actually came up with mathematical formulas.
Right, they refer to them as quants.
Exactly. that you know, can make these people money, whether the stock market goes up or down or whatever.
And, right, but they all went nuts last week.
Exactly. And
That's what happened.
Yeah, and now we're, you know, Tom, you often cite that line from Mussolini, you know, you said, where Mussolini said that, you know, a better name for fascism would be corporatism. And sadly, what we see here with the potential of a bailout of these things is, you know, the government, we act, you know, it's socialism for the rich, you know.
Good point. And in fact, there's one particular blog that I thought was just great. Let me see if I can track it down real quickly here, about how, you know, what we could do with this. Here it is. It's an article by Mark Weisbrot. He's the co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research. And he suggests, getting back to the home mortgage thing, he suggests Congress should pass legislation saying that if you have a mortgage, one of these subprime mortgages, an adjustable rate mortgage, a negative amortization mortgage, if you have a mortgage that you can't afford to pay off, that Congress should pass legislation saying that you have the right to stay in your home as long as you want and become a renter. In other words, the home goes back to the mortgage company. They now own the home. But they are required by law to rent to you at the prevailing rates in the market. Now, why the prevailing rates in the market? Because presumably the loan was made based on the prevailing rates in the market. So it's one of these sort of live by the sword, die by the sword things. This is the way the lender is supposed to determine the size of a mortgage. Homeowners turn the property over to the mortgage holder, then they pay rent for as long as they want. Because they're a renter and they are secure in their ability to rent for years and years, maybe decades, they're going to take care of their property. At some point in the future, they may have the ability to buy the property back if they want. But right now, you know, you've got this solved. And rather than bailing out these multi-million and multi-billion dollar, and in some cases even multi-trillion dollar corporations, rather than, like with the S&L debacle, rather than giving money to the Neil Bushes of the world, to the Silverados of the world, rather than giving money to the banks and to the mortgage companies, why don't we say the government is going to backstop the ability of people to rent in these properties. The properties are going to be owned by the banks. Good luck, bank. You made a bet on this guy. You decided that you were going to take the mortgage application, a ninja application, no income, no job. You decided you're going to do it. Now you have a renter. Good luck. And this is, back to Ravi Batra's point, this is a way of solving the problem that puts money back into the hands of people and drives demand. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
When I see you, all I can think
is,
let's have more babies. Wrinkled and pink, they'll grow up to do what we do so well. That's breed, 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 breed. Yeah,
look out for those breeders.
10 is no big deal. We'll need them so to pay the bills. We're running up for the
Let's see, 1 billion people on planet Earth about the time this country was created. By 1930, we were at 2 billion. Next billion only took 30 years, 1960. That's the third billion. The fourth billion only took 14 years, 1974. The fifth billion only took 13 years, 1987. The sixth billion only took 11 years. So Jim Turr's little song there, breed, breed, breed. Yes. Counting out Edwards would be a big mistake. This is a very, very interesting story in the current issue of Rolling Stone. I just want to call your attention to this. And a tip of the hat to Carl Wolfson, who does the morning show here on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, who pointed it out to me. Thank you, Carl. This from the current issue of Rolling Stone. They say, flying below the radar, the former vice presidential candidate is pulling off a feat that Democratic consultants have long considered impossible. He's staking out the most progressive platform among the viable candidates while preserving an aura of electability. And here's where it gets amazing. And what's frankly to me even more amazing is that this is not being talked about in the corporate media. In head-to-head polling against Rudy Giuliani or Mitt Romney, Clinton and Obama have managed to post only modest leads. John Edwards, by contrast, not only beats every Republican candidate in the race, he trounces them by an average of 12 points. John Edwards is the candidate that the Republicans are the most afraid of. He's the candidate that, now I'm speaking, I'm not quoting from Rolling Stone, he's the candidate that corporate America is most afraid of, and that's why he's the candidate that's very rarely discussed on MSNBC or CNBC or CNN or any of the big three networks, in my humble opinion. Bill Kerik, a veteran party strategist, quoted in Rolling Stone, the new issue, he says, Edwards' message is more left than it was in 04, and it's attracting the right kind of people for the primaries. But the general electorate, still sees him as mainstream. He's doing a good job of threading that needle. And then they point out, while Clinton and Obama are running media age campaigns that focus on big ad buys in delegate-rich states, Edwards is taking a decidedly old-school approach in a strategy reminiscent of the way Jimmy Carter captured New Hampshire in 76. Edwards has focused on building grassroots support in Iowa, Nevada, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, or is it Nevada, the first four Democratic contests, all of which will be held in January. Working out of the national spotlight, he has established a sizable lead in the state where the victory in 2004 clinched John Kerry's nomination. And then they quote James Carville saying that Edwards could well win Iowa, and he could become the candidate to beat in South Carolina and Nevada. And this would establish him as the front runner before the national primary scheduled for the 20 states on February 5th. Chris Lehane, as top strategist for both Kerry and Al Gore, says if Edwards wins Iowa and New Hampshire, he'll have such a head of steam he'll be unstoppable. I think this is good news. I just, you know, it's as somebody who thinks that John Edwards is a good guy. Interesting. The verdict has been decided in the Padilla case. Guilty. Jose Padilla, guilty. That's a very, very interesting one here. And let's see if I can get more. No, I can't get more details for you. They're still coming out, but it's going to take just a minute. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And let's see here, Jeff in Foster City, California. Hey, Jeff, about a minute before we got to take a break at the bottom of the hour. What's up?
Yeah.
Jeff?
I just wanted to mention that the there's redbacks. There's two types of currency that have been produced, one for domestic use and one for international use. And if you John David Morton, apparently a guy at Delphi Associates. He has a newsletter, financial newsletter, Hedgehog, reported this a couple of years ago in Netherlands. Apparently there's in different places there's all this kind of currency available, and apparently it can be tracked by satellites, large amounts of it.
Oh, hang on just a second. I've traveled all over the world, and I've used and received U.S. dollars, and they're the same as the U.S. dollars here.
It's called the redback. It's another type of currency. Remember Bush dumped 400 tons of U.S. currency in the Middle East? Well, apparently there's been a huge production of new U.S. currency with RFID markers in it that can be traced anywhere in the world from satellite, large quantities.
Interesting. If that's the case, why can't they find the $8 billion, that amount that you could see from outer space, that they shipped into Iraq that seems to have vanished? Jose Padilla, guilty on all three counts.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Thirty-four minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a heads up to our listeners in L.A., New York, and San Francisco. Tomorrow, I'll be broadcasting live from our affiliate K-Talk in Los Angeles. And tomorrow night, I will be showing up and doing Q&As at the opening of two of the screenings of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour, at the Landmark West in L.A., and two of them at the Arclight in Hollywood. On Monday, I'll be in New York at the Landmark Sunshine in the East Village. On Tuesday, I'll be in New York at the screening Liberally at the Tank at 9 p.m. for that movie. And on Friday the 24th, we'll be at the San Francisco Landmark Embarcadero. And I'll be doing our show live from WWRL, our affiliate in New York City, on the 20th. And from the Quake in San Francisco on the 24th. So just a quick heads up. You can find the specific times for everything, or over at TomHartman.com, there's a link to the trailer. You can see the trailer for the movie, links to the movie's websites, and if you click on my schedule, it'll get you to which cities we'll be in and where and when we're going to be doing Q&As, and there's even links to the theaters if you're interested in picking up tickets for yourself and bring 50 friends. I mean, this is an extraordinary piece of filmmaking, and Leo DiCaprio will be with us tomorrow morning at 10:30 Pacific Time, 1:30 Eastern Time on this program. Isaiah Poole is with us. It's our Best of the Rest of the News segment, and Isaiah Poole is with us. He's the executive editor of TomPaine.com. Hey, Isaiah.
How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What are you seeing right now as the biggest stories over at TomPaine.com?
Well, one of the things that we've been talking about, in fact, I just got had a little bit of a discussion inside the office about the second anniversary for Hurricane Katrina aftermath that's coming up in about a week or two. And there's an interesting story that Bloomberg actually just broke out of Mississippi. The mythology is that while Louisiana has been mired in corruption with its Democratic leadership, in Mississippi, things under Haley Barbour have been going along quite swimmingly. The truth of the matter is that Bloomberg has a story that has come out today about how Haley Barbour has used the network of his relatives and associates to...
Haley, but we should add the Republican governor?
Yes, the Republican governor, former head of the RNC.
Right.
And has been using a lot of his relatives and friends and has diverted a lot of the hurricane aid money through a network of organizations headed by his relatives and close associates.
What a surprise, a Republican who is using public office to get rich and get his buddies rich. It's never been done. It's never even been thought of. You know, pardon my sarcasm or cynicism or whatever. I mean, I have a feeling that this is not happening in Louisiana, where we have a Democratic. Now, Haley, wait a minute. Haley Barbour is the governor of
Mississippi.
So, yeah, I'm guessing it's not happening in Louisiana, where you have a Democratic governor.
Well, here's the thing. You know,
she and her buddies are not making a fortune.
Well,
or are they?
You know, there's a lot that could be said about the recovery effort in Louisiana, and there's plenty of blame to go around. Certainly, there's a lot of when I was at the Yearly Coast Convention, I heard some real stories that made my blood boil, to be honest, about corruption that was going on there. A lot of it spurred by policies from Republicans in Washington that dictated how money was being used. But, you know, here we have a situation where, the common thread in both Mississippi and Louisiana is cronyism. And cronyism driven by ideology.
Yeah. And thus all the more the tragedy, because, you know, 1,000 lives were lost or more, and hundreds of thousands of lives destroyed. There was an interesting story in I think the AP today, I'm not sure, but read it this morning in the paper, about how post-traumatic stress disorder is spiking now in the New Orleans area and along the Gulf Coast. People, you know, it's even worse than it was a year ago, because initially, you know, when you've recovered from a disaster, there's that period of, oh, thank God I recovered.
Yeah.
And people aren't quite so traumatized. I mean, the trauma has gone away and they're actually kind of bouncing back. But now we are 2 years into the ongoing trauma of the Bush administration screwing up the rebuilding effort down there, it's an ongoing disaster, and now people are being traumatized by the length of time and the horrible living conditions and everything else.
There was a study done by one of the universities down there. People were living in the trailer parks, some of the FEMA trailers, and some of the private trailer parks. Depression levels among the residents in those trailer parks were found to be 3 to 4 times. In fact, the depression levels were about twice the level that you would find among poor welfare recipients.
Right.
These were people who were suffering severe clinical depression.
You know, what people don't realize is that the Ninth Ward, this what's always described as this very poor black area of, largely black area of New Orleans, actually had one of the highest rates of home ownership in New Orleans.
Yeah.
It was a very high percent. I think my recollection is it was over 50 and under 60. It was in that range of a percent of people who actually owned their homes, and some very significant percentage of them, far higher than the national average and far higher than the average for New Orleans, owned their homes outright. I mean, they had been in their families for generations.
Right.
And these are the homes, but these were not wealthy people. The only asset that they owned was their home. And their home now is destroyed. They can't go back to their home. The efforts of the feds and in some cases even the state government is to you know, say, tough luck. Sorry, Charlie. And the insurance companies are all saying, no, we won't. You know, we'll pay off Trent Lott, but we're not going to pay off you. And because Trent Lott could afford to sue. And it's
right.
Just an absolute disaster. Let's move on from this. We're talking with Isaiah Poole, the executive editor of TomPaine.com, our best of the rest of the news segment today here, where every Thursday we check out what's going on in the blogosphere and with our news sources, progressive news sources out on the Internet. The Labor Department has a new strategy. You wrote a piece about it over at Tom Paine. I found this very interesting. Tell me about this.
Well,
the Labor Department, it's supposed to be there to defend the interests of labor, right?
It's supposed to be there. That's the argument that the Labor Department is making. What they're saying is that if you are a member of a labor union, you have an interest in knowing what your labor representatives own, their financial holdings, their financial interests, so that you can ascertain whether there is a conflict of interest that somehow interferes with their ability to represent you as a worker.
Mm-hmm.
So they have taken what's called the LM30. It's a financial disclosure form, and it's a financial form that before now would have been used by about 4,000 labor leaders around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they've expanded the requirements for that form, for filling out that form, so that almost anybody who engages in union activity. If you
so your local shop steward.
If you're a shop steward, you have to fill out this form.
Yeah.
And
this is you describe this as drowning labor in paperwork.
Oh, absolutely.
This is harassment.
I found out about this from a contact at AFL-CIO. This had been remarkably happening sort of under the radar for several months, and basically this is a form where you have to. In some cases, if your wife has, an interest in a, credit union run by the company that you work for, that information has to go on this form. If you're doing a certain amount of union shop steward activity, it's a form that takes at least 2 hours to fill out. It's 9 pages long. It asks for a lot of personal financial information, and this financial information is posted on the Internet.
Jeez, incredible. So the Labor Department going after organized labor in every way they can is the bottom line. This is just incredibly destructive. We're talking with Isaiah Poole, the executive editor of TomPaine.com. And Isaiah, we have a little less than a minute here left. What do you see as the stories on the horizon that nobody's paying attention to that you think are going to be big deals in coming months or weeks?
Well, I don't know if this is an issue that no one's paying attention to, but we're very concerned. We're watching very closely the arguments over these appropriation bills. Sounds dry, but you're talking about a situation where the administration deliberately wants to set up a train wreck with Congress over a total amount of money of about $25 billion,
mm-hmm.
In which the strategy is, with Congress already down to approval ratings, the president can use his veto threats to drive Congress's ratings down even further.
Yeah, another craven political move probably being coordinated by Karl Rove.
Yes.
Isaiah Poole, the executive editor of TomPaine.com. Check it out. Isaiah, thanks for being with us today.
Certainly.
Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls, 866-303-2270, to wrap up the show today. We'll be right back.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Will our pivotal generation create a sustainable world in time?
People need to realize there are things they can do in their everyday lives. Everybody making a change adds up to something meaningful.
Our project today is the welfare of all of life as a practical objective.
With existing technologies, we could literally reduce the human footprint on planet Earth by 90%.
We have to imagine what it would be like to redesign design itself.
These are not technical issues nearly as much as they are leadership issues. There was a time when Republicans and Democrats joined to pass major environmental laws. 500 years out, people look back at this time that this was our finest hour.
What a great time to be born. What a great time to be alive, because this generation gets to completely change this world.
Indeed. And we do, if we have the will to do it. In the meantime, over on the other side, you've got at the top of Think Progress right now, the Center for American Progress's blog about Mueller's notes. The director of the FBI, Mr. Mueller, who was Robert Mueller, taking notes of when Andy Card and Gonzo, Alberto Gonzalez, visited John Ashcroft in the hospital to try and talk him into signing off in a, morphine stupor state, into signing off on a criminal activity by George Bush. And Ashcroft refused to do it. Now, Congress signed off on it recently, all the Republicans in the House and Senate, and a couple of crazed Democrats. But Ashcroft refused to do it. You can find all the details over there at thinkprogress.org. 1-866-303-2270. Susan in Massachusetts, listening on WHMP. Hey, Susan.
Hi, Tom. I am so thrilled to have the opportunity to talk to you. I am calling because I want to thank you for your comments about our healthcare system. I am a physician, I'm a surgeon, and I've been practicing for over 20 years, and I think it is critical that our society understands exactly where the money for healthcare is going, and it is being siphoned off by executives such as the CEOs you were describing earlier today. And I really am concerned that we are in such a healthcare crisis that as physicians, we are unable to practice safe medicine now because we do not have the resources available to provide you as our patients the care that you need.
Yeah, and at the same time, Bill Frist's brother and his father are billionaires with a B in because of the profits they've been able to siphon off from the institutions where you practice surgery.
Well,
not necessarily literally your hospital, but you know
well, absolutely, but they weren't doing that as physicians. They were doing that maybe as physician leaders.
No, they were doing it as the owners of the of the Hospital Corporation of America.
Absolutely, because as a for-profit institution.
That's right.
But we need to, you know, first of all, you need to look at the majority of physicians are dedicated to taking care of patients. We provide free care many times in our on a daily basis when patients are unable to pay for something. We still order the test even though it's not going to be covered by their insurance because morally and ethically we know it's the right thing to do. And that's one of the reasons that insurance companies and executives for these for-profits have been able to really take advantage of physicians because physicians are not going to compromise your care as a patient, whether or not they're going to be paid for it. But if people need to understand at this point, it really is. I have a number of friends that are physicians also that are in private practice that are unable to really balance their books, and they're really considering leaving the profession. These are dedicated people. All their entire life, what they wanted to do is help people, and now they're being financially squeezed out of the opportunity.
Right. And at the same time, Bill McGuire walking off with over $1 billion, Bill Frist's daddy walking off with $1 billion.
Absolutely.
It's mind-boggling. Susan, have you seen Sicko?
I have seen Sicko. Yes, I have.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you agree with Michael Moore's prognosis and his suggestion that, you know, we just need to do what France is doing and have a national health care program?
I think so, but I think we need to look at the lobbyists that are really going to try and block that because there is a lot of our gross national profit that goes into medicine. And when you ask yourselves as citizens of this country, what is the most important thing? Ask anyone that's when you're sick, you know what your most important thing is? Your health.
That's right.
We all take that for granted, but nothing else matters. You need a roof over your head and you need to feed yourself, but, you know, you don't need a second car, you don't need a second home, but you need your health. And that, if that's what we value, we as Americans want to put our extra money and a great portion of our gross national profit, but you really need to give the people that are taking care of you this money. You need to.
Very, very well said. Susan, I have to move along, but your point is very well made. I appreciate your call.
And please keep up bringing it back to where the money's going.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, Susan. Mary Ann in Arcata, California. Hey, Mary Ann.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, to continue on when this surgeon talked about the Hospital Corporation of America, I just found out that in 2006, their revenues was $25 billion, like B like in Bill. So I've been calling up about 11 or 12 senators' offices in Congress and asking them if there's an oversight committee somewhere they could answer these three questions. How much did HCA pay out salaries and bonuses to their CEOs and their 13 directors on the board? And those directors all have top jobs on those global equity firms on Wall Street. And number two, corporate taxes, how much did they pay in for that? And three, how much did they pay out to those shareholders that make money off of sick people? And, and so I call back in a week, and, of course, nobody has done anything and nobody knows anything in all those senators' offices.
Yeah.
So I don't know
all the more the tragedy.
Huh?
No, well, what we're going to do is we're going to get mad as hell. Not going to take it anymore. Marianne, thank you for the call. I mean, this is the point. Our elected representatives are getting an earful Yeah, Ron Wyden was in town, the senator from Oregon. You know, 300-400 people showed up and to talk about issues ranging from health care to impeachment to the war in Iraq. As this vacation is going on, our elected members are getting out in their districts, and boy, are they getting an earful, and it's a fine thing for democracy. Tomorrow, brunch with Bernie Sanders here. Leo DiCaprio will be here with us in the second hour. All that and more, plus your calls. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.